Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
If the Lakers are looking for a savior, without Anthony Davis, they don't need to hit the buyout market. They don't need to make that deal. They don't need to swing a deal. They just need to look for one guy. And I'm talking about Montrezl Harrell. Better yet, I'm talking about Montrezl Harrell. Because Montrezl just earned the full government treatment. Now, before I say what I'm about to say, let me be very clear about this. The Lakers are going to try to take a team approach to replace Anthony Davis. There's no way you can find one guy to step up and fill the stat sheet the way he does. So, it's going to be by committee. There's going to be some LeBron, some from Dennis, some from Marc Gasol. But I'm also expecting to see a lot from Montrezl. Because more of him on the floor and behind the mic is a good thing. In fact, as you're about to find out, it's the best thing. And if Laker fans didn't know that before, they know it now. First off, he gave you all a quick hit of good news on the AD front. He posted this video of his elevator ride with AD. And as you'll notice, AD is in really good spirits.
I didn't even know this elevator went up to PH.
I don't know who it is. Are you on PH? That's crazy.
I'm going to keep recording. So.
Come on, bro.
I want you to get back in. You know that me. Come on, go to your room.
We ain't going tomorrow.
See you, dog.
All right, so the audio is fine. The audio is good. The video tells the entire picture. And if you want to get all Zapruder with it, in that film, AD is wearing sneakers and no walking boot. And he's walking without a limp. So that's all good news. But the real good news is how Harrell showed up last night against the T-Wolves. 17-6-3, but in only 18 minutes. He did all that work in 18 minutes. He was attacking the glass like this.
California guy, Matthews doesn't get it. Great rebound. Doing work, Montrezl. Count it.
Well, if you don't box out at any level, but especially in the NBA, you're up against it.
Right? Montrezl doing work. And throwing down on dudes like this.
Fans here in Southern California. Montrezl, the muscle, and he throws it down.
Montrezl throwing it down and jumping into passing lanes too.
Four steals tonight for Schroeder. Rubio, Montrezl. Montrezl goes and gets it. Harrell all the way. Harrell scores.
All right, so what I'm saying is that is the sixth man of the year doing sixth man of the year things. But the best part of Harrell showing up like this is not what he brings to the court. It's what he brings to the media after being on the court. This is officially a Montrezl Harrell appreciation take. After all, we're talking about a guy who just lets it rip. Back when he was with the Clippers and he found out that Kyle Kuzma and John Collins had higher ratings in NBA 2K, he tweeted, quote, "It's a bleeping joke, but it's okay." End of quote. Last night, then, he was asked about the challenge of defending a bigger center like Karl Anthony Towns. Now, for context, Cat is listed at 6'11", 250. Montrezl listed at 6'7", 237. So he's giving up 4 inches to Cat. But don't come to him with any of that junk, because he's not having any of it.
I don't really believe in that smaller stuff, man, because at the end of the day, if you believe in that, man, then the elephant will be the king of the jungle, and that ain't happening.
Man, that is such a good line. That is such a good line. I don't believe in that smaller guy stuff, because if you believed in that, the elephant would be the king of the jungle, and that ain't happening. That is one of the most Montrezl lines ever. Not only is he not going to talk about the strategies as the smaller man in that matchup, he just rejects the premise completely. Then he comes out with some science. Get out of here with your smaller man stuff. Because if it did matter, the elephant would be the king of the jungle. And as Montrezl himself said, quote, "That ain't happening." You know what else was not happening last night? Cat going off for a huge night when Montrezl was around. He had even more.
I come at him and I put my hard hat on like everybody else. Everybody on this team, everybody in this league know that I ain't nobody to bat down from nobody. I don't care what your size is. I don't care what you do. So,
man, this guy, this is the best. So if you're still wondering about how he attacks the game, if you're still wondering, and I don't know why you would be at this point, but if you're still wondering, this should end that discussion.
As far as that giving up size stuff, you know, people know me around this league, man. They know I'm back down from nobody.
Right. He does not back down from anybody. And if you thought that was ever going to happen, then you're a fool. Ever since this guy came out of Louisville, this dude has not backed down from anybody at all, ever. The next guy he backs down from will be the first. And there is no way that he was going to back down from Cat, no matter how tall he is. Man, this guy could have showed up last night rolling in a tank. And Montrez would have still gotten over somehow, some way. Cat had 15 and 6 in 33 minutes. Worse numbers than Harrell had in nearly double the time on the floor. And that right there is proof as to why the Lion is the king of the jungle and Monstertrez was the king of the court. Lakers have the Nets tomorrow night in LA. It's going to be great. Can't wait to see that. But from the sounds of it, Montrez is not going to treat that as some sort of finals preview or anything of the sort.
No, we're not circling that game. We're not putting any extra emphasis on that game. It's just like any other game. We're taking it one game at a time.
All right, so normally I'd say, great cliche, thanks for that. Except I respect it. I get it. It doesn't mean that he's overlooking the Nets or that he's not focused on the Nets. It means he's going to attack that game the way he attacks every single game because that's how that guy shows up every single night. Like, I don't know how that game's going to go. I just know that Montrez is not going to back down from anyone. You could have him on KD, Kyrie, and James Harden all at the same time. This dude is not backing down. The Lion does not give up anything to an elephant. Montrez does not give up anything to anyone. The Lion will eat the elephant. And believe this, Monstertrez is going to show up and eat every damn time.
Eat it,
huh? My man's going to eat. I like that. Starting you off with a little Laker take. So again, 80 out 2 to 3 weeks. Does not mean 2 to 3 weeks. And there is no one guy that can fill that stat sheet up like AD. But you got Monstertrez there. And he's going to do everything he can. Peter DeBoer is my guest. Peter, it's great to have you back. How are you?
Great, Jim. Great to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you again. Let me rephrase that, actually. You've been around the league a long, long time. But the last 12 months, Peter, have not been like anything anybody has ever seen. So how are you doing and how are things around the team, given what's gone on?
Yeah, wow. It's been an interesting year. I mean, we paused the season in February, came back, and had a playoff bubble in Edmonton, Alberta in August, September, October. And then our off season was a month in November and then returned to play in early January. So it feels like three seasons in a span of 1 year, and something I hope to never go through again.
Man, no doubt. Peter DeBoer is joining us. You know, everything is so strange. As an example, you're in the middle of what is effectively a four-game stretch with Colorado. I mean, that's something you'd be used to in the playoffs, but what's it like to go through something like that during the regular season, and how do you approach it?
You know what? I really like it, Jim. I think you can really build some battles and some animosity between the teams. It feels like mini playoff series during the season, and you know, even from a referee point of view, when you talk to them, you can feel the battles carrying over game to game. So I think you get a real intensity to the games. I think from a coaching perspective, it's nice to, because you get that playoff feel where you can make game to game adjustments against the same team over a 3 or 4 game series. So I think that's been one of the nice benefits of what we're doing.
Are you craving some protein after a good workout? This time, do not make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender and made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business which takes smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, rough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating an old shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors: old-fashioned, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy. Next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Peter DeBoer is joining us. Now, you're dealing with some injuries, of course, and because of that, Marc-Andre Fleury has had to play a lot of games. What do you make of the way he has responded to that challenge?
He's been outstanding. You know, this guy's a consummate pro. You know, he's a Hall of Fame goaltender. I think he's 36. We brought in Robin Lehner last year, and Robin kind of took the crease over in the playoff bubble, but Marc-Andre, to his credit, came back to camp this year, and instead of just submitting to being the backup, he's been outstanding since training camp, and he deserves to be in there every night right now.
You know, Peter, it seems to me, at least from the outside looking in, that when I see the team, it feels like you've got a team that can skate and play a wide-open game, but at the same time, you can lock it up or they can lock it up and grind it out if that's what's necessary. How do you explain that level of versatility, and then what's that mean for you as a head coach when you know you can attack opponent in a variety of different ways?
Yeah, I think that's something that we're working towards. I think every time you go into the playoffs and you don't win, you realize that you need another layer to your game in order to win the ultimate prize. And I think Tampa is a perfect example of that, winning the Stanley Cup last year. They were always a skill speed team. They went out and added some pieces, some grit. They changed a little bit of their identity, and all of a sudden they've been able to take the next step. So I think we're trying to do that. We've got a lot of speed and skill. I think we've got a big team. I think on paper, the biggest team in the NHL. So we have the ability to play that heavy physical game. We added Alex Pietrangelo in the summer, who's one of the best defensemen in the world, and great goaltending. So we think we've got a good formula here.
Yeah, it seems like you've got some really, really strong play behind the blue line. What about Saturday? You're going up against Colorado, and it's going to be outdoors at Lake Tahoe. What kind of thoughts do you have about that game and that experience?
Well, it's funny. You talk to our players, and everybody reverts back to childhood memories and nostalgia when we play outdoors. And that's how everybody grew up playing hockey. It wasn't in a rink at $400 an hour for ice time. It was on the local pond or the frozen river or the frozen lake near your house. And so I think these events are always special. I think that's why the NHL put them in the first place, and that's why they've lasted. The players love it, the coaches love it, and I think it's a great fan experience. Even though we won't have live fans on TV with that setting at Lake Tahoe, I think will be outstanding.
I think it's so cool. I love those setups. From a coaching perspective, is it just another game, or does it feel different, and do you approach it differently than just another game?
No, it's not just another game. You know, I think the venue makes it a little different in your approach, in that, the ice isn't going to be as perfect as indoor ice. The snow might be flying. There might be some wind to deal with. So I think you have to be prepared to talk about and deal with some of the elements of it. But it's not just another game from a personal point. I think the players know that the entire hockey world is watching these games, and everything's heightened, and everybody wants to win it even more for that reason.
Vegas Golden Knights head coach Peter DeBoer joining me for a few more moments. And then last month, Peter, the entire coaching staff had a quarantine, which meant that GM Kelly McCrimmon was behind the bench for the game against the Blues. What was that entire experience like for you?
Yeah, well, we had three of our coaching staff get COVID, and I was included in that. And we were down and out for a couple weeks in quarantine and dealing with some symptoms. So thankfully, we all got through the other side of it healthy. But, I think it gave our GM a chance to coach. He had a coaching background, so it wasn't an issue for him. But I think it's great. I think every GM should step behind the bench and coach every once in a while, just to get that feel to know what we go through down there.
Right. Peter, one last thought before you go. In terms of what I said about what you have behind the blue line, as an example, after Sunday's win, Fleury was giving a lot of praise to defenseman Zach Whitecloud. It seems like his career has taken off since you arrived with the team. What do you see in him, or what did you see in him initially that made you think he might be special?
Well, I didn't know anything about this kid until I took the job, and our general manager said we should take a look at him. He was having a good year in the minor leagues. We brought him up, and, you know, he was one of those kids that just got better every single day. He sleeps, eats, breathes hockey. He loves the game. He's a student of the game. He wants to learn, and, you know, he's just gotten better every night, and he's turned himself into a real exceptional player.
So last thought, he's 24, and then you've got fellow defenseman Dylan Coghlan, who's only 22. So how do you explain the fact that you've got guys who are that young, but they're showing up in the NHL, and they're so well prepared that they can make an impact almost immediately?
Well, I think this organization has done development right. They haven't rushed kids in at 19, 18. You know, they've sent them back to college for an extra year. They've played in the minors for a year or two, and they've stuck to that development model. And I think when the kids get here, they're ready, and they're more ready and more able to take advantage of that opportunity. So I think that's where the credit belongs.
He is head coach of the Vegas Golden Knights. Vegas is in first in the West, and it's going to be a lot of fun Saturday. You've got Vegas versus Colorado in Lake Tahoe. Peter DeBoer, my guest. Peter, great to have you back. Always appreciate that visit. Have a great weekend.
You too, Jim. Thanks.
All right, let's talk for a minute about double screening, the norm of the new world. Now, you might not be familiar with that, but it's exactly what it sounds like. Double screening. It's consuming content from two screens at the same time. We all do it. You probably do it and don't even know you're doing it. For instance, you ever watch TV while scrolling Instagram on your phone? Of course, right? That's double screening. Ever crush Netflix and catch up on your email from the laptop at the same time? Double screening. Hell, the only way to live tweet a game is to double screen it, because you've got the event on the tube and you've got Twitter on your blower. So, double screening is a thing, and you're doing it, and you might not even know you're doing it. But it can be a mindless black hole where precious time is wasted in enormous quantities, and it can be splitting aces and winning both hands. I mean, it just depends how you do it, when you do it, how you do it. Like last night. Last night was splitting aces and winning both hands. What feels better than that, right? You get a couple of aces, split them, hit that, bam. That's what last night was. Because on the one screen, you had Jeopardy contestants doing Jeopardy contestant things. No Alex Trebek, no problem. That dude did not take their lack of sports knowledge with him. Nerds gonna nerd. And nerds do not know sports. Check out guest host Ken Jennings reading this clue to a bunch of crickets last night.
Recently, this baller barista launched Big Face Coffee and turned his new team, the Miami Heat, into a title contender. We were looking for Jimmy Butler.
Woof. And how you gonna do my guy Jimmy B like that? We only talked about him and his coffee and the bubble every single day for several weeks on this show. How are you going to do that guy like that, nerds? The guy was on national TV for 2 months straight. He took LeBron to 6 games like yesterday, nerds. He plays in a major media market. He launched a successful and hilarious coffee brand. His picture was being shown to you all while Ken Jennings read the clue. And they name dropped his team. They could not have given you any more help than they did, nerds. How are you going to miss that? How are you going to miss that? Seymour Skinner cannot believe how obvious Jeopardy made that.
A certain agitator, for privacy's sake, let's call her Lisa S. No, that's too obvious. Let's say L. Simpson.
Let's call him Jimmy B. No, that's too obvious. Let's just call him J. Butler.
We were looking for Jimmy Butler.
Let's just call him Jimmy Butler. They still wouldn't have gotten it right. This basketball player's name is Jimmy Butler. Yes, Dolores. Lou Alcindor? No, that's not right. Your clue is, this NBAer's name is Jimmy Butler. Who is Babe Ruth? Jimmy Butler could have been wearing a name tag in that photo. The name tag could have been, "Hi, my name is Jimmy Butler." And one of those nerds would have been like, "Who is Parker?" They still weren't getting it. "Jimmy, my man, you are still household around here. Much respect." So that was on TV. Over on Twitter, you had the Sandman, Adam Sandler, posting a video from the golf course to commemorate the 25th anniversary, 25 years of Happy Gilmore. And the video was complete with a shout out to the villain and a trademark running start drive from the tee box itself.
"Okay, it's been 25 years since I've done this. Let's see what happens.
Shooter McGavin, this is for you.
And I'm not lying to you, that is smash. Smash.
And that went pretty well.
You dead, Shooter."
The only thing better than hearing it is watching it. And the only thing better than watching it would have been if that drive hit some dude standing on his front porch 400 yards away.
"You hit that guy.
He shouldn't have been standing there."
Like, Happy Gilmore isn't just the best golf movie of all time. It's one of the best movies of all time in any genre. Every line is quotable. Every scene is memorable. Every character is lovable. Even the villain, Shooter McGavin. Speaking of which, Chris McDonald saw that video, and he responded yesterday as Shooter McGavin.
"Nice drive, Gilmore. 25 years, huh? Let's see if it's Shooter's tour. Shooter, still got it. Why don't you just meet me at the ninth green at 9, Gilmore? Little secret of the pro. Oh, and Gilmore, wear something nice."
2021, and Happy Gilmore and Shooter McGavin are still trading verbal haymakers and quoting their iconic cult classic from the 90s. Like, literally the best use of Twitter ever. And then it still got better, because then out of nowhere, Ben Stiller, the uncredited orderly, fires off a tweet to Sandler, which reads, quote, "Beautiful swing, Mr. Gilmore. So happy to be a small part of taking good care of your grandma during her golden years.
Sir, could I trouble you for a glass of warm milk?"
"You could trouble me for a warm glass of..."
"Shut the hell up. Now you will go to sleep, or I will put you to sleep.
Check out the name tag. You're in my world now, Grandma."
Twitter can walk off on that yesterday, because it's not going to get any better than that. Not going to get any better than Sandler, Stiller, and Shooter doing a digital table read of Happy Gilmore in 2021. It's just not going to get better. It's not. So save your fatty Grillmore jokes and your emails about how much of a bum Sandler looked like yesterday with his unbuttoned shirt and Costco shorts. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to have it. And it's not going to see the light of day here, because that was awesome. If you don't get that, that's a you thing, not a them thing. So we've gone from TV to Twitter. Let's bounce back to TV for a minute, where Brady is once again a news item. And yes, I know I promised no more Brady after 9 straight days of Brady talk. But I can't help where the stories take me. Yesterday, it was all about Brady and the Bills. And yes, you heard me correctly. Brady and the Bills. Last night, down under in Australia, there was a women's quarterfinal match at the Aussie Open featuring Jessica Pegula. Who's Jessica Pegula, you ask? Oh, nobody. Nobody at all. Just the daughter of Bill's owners, Kim and Terry Pegula. Hell yes, the Mafia has Grand Slam tennis representation. And by the way, damn good representation of that. She's been murdering it. After back-to-back upsets, she was in the quarters of a Grand Slam event. I mean, do you have any idea how awesome that is? How impressive that is? Their daughter is not only a professional tennis player, but she's in the quarters of a slam. 3 steps away from winning a major. Who's standing in her way? Who is the opponent? Wait for it. Jen Brady?
No!
The Buffalo Bills v. Brady. But of course. And what do you think happened when a Bill came up against Brady?
Oh, well done, Jen Brady, into the semifinals.
Hate to say it, Mafia, but death, taxes, and Brady beating the Bills. Hate to say that, Mafia, but Brady still owns the Bills. Do not shoot the messenger. And finally, from TV to Twitter, back to TV, and now right back to Twitter again, here's audio of Eli Manning getting snipered on the mountain while attempting to ski and film his kids yesterday. That's a laugh of somebody who just had something really embarrassing happen to him. Let me know that Eli was on the flat of a bunny hill with his kids, strapped to a couple of K2 twigs, and nothing touched him. Again, the video way better than the audio, but toggling from the TV back to Twitter and having the nightcap of watching America's Little Bro getting sacked in retirement was pretty awesome. Even if it was a phantom sack. Eli's got the same mobility on skis that he had in the pocket. Pretty much none. So here's to a great night of double screening. Cheers to you, Twitter and TV. You both were pretty damn good yesterday. That's what I mean when I say Twitter is either the best or worst thing ever, depending on your day. Yesterday, it was one of the best things ever. Double screen, man, it's fun. It works. Any credit card can offer cash back, but only Discover matches all the cash back that you earned at the end of your first year. It's like getting one of those birthday cards that's shaped like cash, so you already know there's cash inside before you open it up. But in this case, it's stuffed with your first year cash back match, and you don't even have to send a thank you note. How awesome is that? Willie Mack III joins us. Willie, it's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good. Dude, you, man, what a story you have. I was so anxious to talk to you, but let me start right here. You're going to tee off tomorrow at 8:19 a.m. at RIV. Before we get into that, in order for people to understand what this week and the last few weeks have really meant, can we go back a little bit? Back in the day, you and your dad used to go to the Buick Open in Michigan as fans. What do you remember about going to those events with your father?
Just being there as a little kid, watching all the pros, hit it farther. At that time, I was probably hitting about 150 yards. So just seeing them hit the ball, it made a different sound. And it's just funny how time flies by, and I'm in the same position.
Yeah, absolutely in the same position, but you took a very different route than pretty much anybody else. I know you're not looking for a lot of attention, but your story really is incredible, and it really is inspiring. I'm hopeful that you're up to talking about some of this. Like, the story goes that when you were 12, you officially got hooked on golf. What was it about the game and the sport that you liked so much when you were young?
Just being able to go out there with my dad, I think it just brought us a bond that was that nobody could take away. So it's just a loving game. A lot of people play it nowadays, and I just feel like it's one of the greatest sports and games in the world.
Willie Mack III is joining us. You mentioned the word love. I think that's a perfect way to describe what I'm about to ask you about, because your father made so many sacrifices for you to make sure that you could keep golfing. Examples like when you were in high school, the school announced that it was going to end the golf team. Your dad rents a house in a different school district so you can keep playing golf. What are those types of sacrifices, the ones that he made for you so you could chase that dream? How much did that mean to you, that support and that love?
As a kid, you really don't know what your parents go through just to be able to get you just to basketball practice, golf practice, anything. So the older I got, I look back and it gets you emotional to think that you have somebody in your corner that will honestly do anything to see you succeed. And I'm glad he did it, and I definitely can't thank him enough for doing that.
Willie Mack III, my guest. So then the story goes, on top of that, you were driving your grandfather's car. You were playing on the Florida Pro Golf Tour. You were dominating. Then you get a shot at Q School, but you fell just short of qualifying directly for the PGA Tour. What was that moment like for you?
That being the last year to get right to the PGA Tour, it kind of was a different feeling. Nobody knew what was going to happen after that. So nowadays you can only go to Corn Ferry Tour, but I played good coming right out, and I had one little bad first round, but I kind of got it back going the last three rounds, and I think I missed it by two strokes. So hopefully this week can change all those memories and have a great week.
William Mack III is joining us. Just being here makes it a great week. I mean, for example, it's really expensive to pursue a career in golf when you do not have a sponsor, and you have to do whatever you can to save money. The story also goes that you were sleeping in your car for nearly 2 years and using borrowed clubs. Like, I've never heard of anything like that. I don't know anybody else who would even attempt something like that. Why? What kept you going? How did you not fold and give in and give up?
Yeah, that year and a half, 2 years, sleeping on friends' couches, trying to make enough money just to get a hotel. It was a struggle at that time. Probably my lowest in my career. So I just always remember what my dad sacrificed to get me to where I am, and I think I never gave up because of not only me wanting to get to the PGA Tour, but also not to let him down.
William Mack III is joining us. I'm going to get to the good stuff in 1 second, but there's just one more story that I think really needs to be mentioned. In 2018, you're driving your Kia on the highway, and then it dies. What do you remember about what happened next?
I pulled over to the side of the road. I was probably sitting there for about 30 minutes, and two cars actually just stopped in front of me, and they kind of started running towards my car, and they just were waving their hands, saying, "Oh, your car's on fire." And I got out, looked at my car. The whole front end was gone, and the first thing I thought was get my golf clubs out. So I got my golf clubs out, threw them on the side of the road. I actually tried to get back into the car. It wouldn't open. So the guy that stopped told us to just get away from the car. Probably got about 6 feet away, and it blew up. So I'm glad he stopped and told me to get away from the car, or who knows what happened after that.
Yeah, that would have been the worst thing imaginable. But in fact, you got your clubs out of there, but pretty much everything else you had was in that car, right?
Yeah, I was actually coming from a golf tournament and going to another golf tournament at the time. So I had all my belongings, shoes, clothes. So that all got burned up. But the golf community came along and kind of helped me out. And got some of those things back.
Willie Mack III is joining us. And then you've got Ken Bentley. Willie, he's the CEO of the Advocates Pro Golf Association. He told the Golf Channel, and I quote, "If I had a guy on our tour that I needed to play one round to save my life, I'd pick Willie. He'd fight all the way to the end," end quote. It's incredible praise. What's that mean to you to hear that?
Just coming from him, he's a great guy. He's definitely done a lot for my golfing career. And also, the APGA Tour, it's a great tour to try to get diversity into the game of golf, and I can't thank him enough also for where I'm at today.
So I mentioned also, Willie, at the very top that you were named to receive the Charlie Sifford Memorial Exemption for this week. What kind of emotions did you feel when you found that out, and what was it like when you told your father that that would be happening?
Yeah, we always dreamt of it the last couple of years to get that exemption. Just getting an exemption after the name of Charlie Sifford, arguably the Jackie Robinson, the golfer for African Americans, it's an honor to get that, and especially being Tiger Woods hosting it, looking up to him my whole golfing career. It's just amazing to be able to play at this course.
We're talking to William Mack III for a couple of more moments. You know, the thing is, originally this week was going to be your debut on the PGA Tour, but when Kamaiu Johnson was diagnosed with COVID before the Farmers, you took his place. What do you remember about that week? What was that experience like?
Yeah, I got in maybe less than 36 hours. I had to get accustomed to two courses that I never played, so it almost gave me – I had no time to be nervous. So I think that helped me out to be able to come to this tournament and kind of feel like it's just another a mini tour event. So I really think it was supposed to happen the way it did, just to get me ready for this tournament. And
I'm super excited for this week.
I was going to say, let's talk mindset really quickly. Like, you shot 74 and then you shot 75 in the second round. A strong showing, but even stronger when you consider the fact that, as you point out, you had not seen the full course before you played it. And then after you missed the cut, you found out that you'd been playing with a cracked driver. So knowing all of that and the prep you've done at RIV, how much confidence do you have going into this week?
Yeah, it feels amazing to be able to get your preparation done. I actually went to RIV that Sunday when I missed the cut at Torrey and played 27 holes. I got a new driver and missed one fairway. So driver is good this week, and I just can't wait to get out there and show my skills to everybody.
All right, so the driver's good. How's the putter right about now?
The putter's good too, so we're feeling good.
All right, so great. Last thought. When people know your story and they know what you have fought through to get to this spot, it's really inspiring. So what do you say to somebody who maybe right now is listening and they're fighting for a dream and they're not getting there and they're starting to lose hope and they're starting to lose faith? What would you say to them about staying in the fight and staying in that grind?
Yeah, you just can never give up. Everybody goes through struggles. They're all different. But hopefully you keep working hard, and those struggles don't last forever. So I would just say keep your head down and look at the bigger picture, and hopefully everything works out in the way it's supposed to.
There you go. An 11-time winner in college, a 65-time winner on the mini tours, and he is playing in this week's Genesis Invitational as the Charlie Sifford Memorial Exemption recipient. On behalf of the Tiger Woods Foundation, Willie, great to have you on the show finally. Have a great week, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me.
It is February 17th. So what does that represent? What does that mean? That means we're 48 days into the new year. So why don't I go ahead and ask the question that we already know the answer to? How are those resolutions going? Are you still working out every single day? Are you still spinning Rosetta Stone in your AirPods? Are you still dieting? Are you still reading? Are you still organizing? No? Yeah, I didn't think so. And I'm not saying that I'm any better than you, because some of the things that I thought that I would do are not getting done. And 48 days can be a pretty long time. A long time to do anything. Like, how long does it take to break a bad habit? How long does it take to replace a bad habit with a new good habit? How can anybody be expected to carry out meaningful change for an entire month and a half? It's tough, right? Give yourself a pat on the back for even considering it. Now, some real talk. Next time January 1st rolls around, just call it your new week resolution instead of your new year resolution. That way you will not feel the shame and the embarrassment when you're called out for giving up 13% of the way through 2021. So why do I bring this up? Why am I hammering away at resolutions that are not met or fulfilled? Because former MVP turned NFL free agent Cam Newton has a resolution that he just went public with. And he did so this week in a video which he dropped on YouTube. And it was not on the first, but check it out.
So one of my hobbies, or what I would say one of my stress diffusers, is to shop. And one of my New Year's resolutions is to not buy high fashion.
All right, so I think if you listen to what he said, I think a lot of people can relate to that, right? We all cope in different ways. And folks who have trouble coping might reach for the bottle. Or they might reach for sugar, or they might go shopping. You know, like I'm no psychologist, and I'm no therapist, and I'm no professional, but I'm guessing that the dopamine starts popping when you buy something new and shiny, right? That's why people do it. He just called it. When I'm looking for a stress diffuser, I shop. So his hobby and stress reliever is shopping. And it's pretty obvious, given this dude's looks throughout the years, that that is one of the ways he diffuses stress. And for the record, I'm not knocking it. I can't lie to you. I've done it myself. In fact, I do it myself. Not to that extent, but I'll go find a new case for my iPhone. I'll do something like that because something comes in the mail and it comes the next day and it feels pretty good, right? Now, in terms of Cam and what he rocks, it takes a certain kind of dude to pull off that look. all of those looks. The capris, the ascots. Like, I don't have that kind of game. I don't have that in me. Cam does, and more power to him because he does. And fits and fashion and clothing are his thing. So it's interesting that his New Year's resolution would be to stop buying high fashion. It's got to be a reason, right?
I want to be more of a thrift store shopper. I want to be more of a vintage shopper. I want to be more of a person that finds gems in stores that are less expensive.
All right. I see Cam working. He's going to give up the high fashion life and switch genres to thrift store shopping. Vintage picking. Pretty cool. Like, my kid Jake is about that life. A lot of people are. So it's not as unusual or as weird as it might seem. But did you hear that part at the end of the clip where Cam says he wants to shop at stores that are, quote, less expensive? That's interesting. Now, I'm not telling this guy to spend his money, but he did bank about $123 million in football contracts alone. So I'm sure that he can afford whatever he wants. Or can he? Check this out.
And I've spent thousands of dollars, maybe even millions of dollars, on clothes that I only wore once.
I'm sorry, but did my dude just say he has spent millions of dollars on clothes that he has only worn once?
And I've spent thousands of dollars, maybe even millions of dollars, on clothes that I only wore once.
My guy Antoine Walker cannot believe that. Antoine famously went through an NBA season once and bought 82 suits, one for each game, because he could not wear the same suit twice. This is kind of what Cam's talking about, I think. Millions of bones on threads that only get one wear. Now, I know a lot of you are not cool or down with Cam, and you're coming for him no matter what. No matter what this guy says, no matter what he does, no matter how well he plays or how poorly he plays or how good he looks or how bad he looks, you're coming for this guy. Some of you just are. I'm not one of those guys. I like Cam. So just chill out for a second. I understand this kind of lavish and impractical lifestyle. I understand that it can bother you and that you would not get that. But you need to understand this. He's doing this or did that for the same reason anybody does anything. They can. If you're an athlete and you're a top athlete and you're in this country, you're going to make a hell of a lot of money. Fact. You might not like what he spends his money on, and you might resent that you don't make that kind of money. But the reason you don't, you can't do what he can do. And there's a premium on what he can do, especially what he used to be able to do. And you can spend your money on whatever you want to spend your money on, right? I understand this. Now, wearing what he's wearing is a double-edged sword. It just is. Like, if you wear something super flashy and loud, you're going to make a statement, and it's going to get a lot of attention, and everybody's going to see it. And then if you try and run it back, everybody has already seen it. So there's a stigma against wearing it twice for whatever reason. I'm not saying that I buy into that, but it's true. If you have this amazing look, it's hard to run it back again. Either you're repeating something artistic that you've already done, or you're just showing a lack of creativity. But there is an unspoken status and an ego thing that you're putting at risk if you get caught wearing the same amazing fit twice. Akeem Tlaib and I talked about this recently on my podcast. He broke out this unbelievable winter suit. He went to his person who makes his suits and said, "Give me a great, great seasonal fit." And the suit was incredible, and it hit every blog, everybody talked about it, but he also admitted it was a big waste of money because I can't ever run it back. I can't wear that suit ever again. It's a one-off. So imagine spending thousands and thousands on a suit that you can only wear once. So you got to find other stuff. And apparently that's what Cam is doing. He's smart, right? Cam is going to look elsewhere. He's going to trade in Gucci and Louis for Goodwill and the Salvation Army. All right, my man's getting responsible with it. The man is getting his Macklemore on at the thrift shop before he goes broke. He's making life-changing resolutions to stop gassing millions on things that he can only wear once. I like it. I like it, and I like how open he is about it. I don't think the guy's flexing. I think he's being real. His favorite thing is fashion, and he knows it's going to bleed him dry if he does not find it in different places at better prices. In the video, he goes to LA, and he goes on a pick to end all picks. My man is rummaging around thrift stores because he has to wear something different every day. It's kind of awesome, I think. Good luck finding two shoes that match. Good luck finding a sweater that doesn't have a stain on it, but I'm here for it. I don't need to tell Cam to do Cam because Cam will always do Cam. But you do you, Cam. I respect it. And my man Antoine Walker, he owned it. Man, he came on our podcast, or actually on my Showtime program, and we talked about the fact that he bought a suit for every single game during one NBA season.
Nobody dressed like you back in the day. You had some really flashy suits. Is it true, Antoine, that you'd wear them once and then never again?
Yeah, I used to wear, well, every season I would get 82 suits made, and then I'll.
How many?
82 was 82 games, right?
82 suits. 82 suits?
Yeah.
Per year?
Yeah.
What were those suits running you back in the day?
A custom suit for myself, because I'm a bigger guy, was anywhere between $1,500 to $1,800 a suit.
And after you wore them once, what happened to them?
It's in my closet. I mean, I would probably wear them down the line maybe next year, but every year, you know, for about a good stretch, about 5 or 6 years, I got new suits every game.
Let's go ahead and do the math. My man sitting on more than 400 suits. 400 suits. And you might say to yourself, yeah, but suits, a finely made suit would last you forever. Yeah, but they go out of style. Like back in the day when I was buying suits, a lot of suits, and I still buy suits, I can just see from year to year or year to 3 years or year to 4 years, my guy David August, the style's changed dramatically, dramatically. Like I could look at a suit and you think to yourself, yeah, but if it's a really nice suit, if it's a $1,500 suit or an $1,800 suit, you're going to keep that suit forever. Yeah, but if you're that guy, you know, if you're a baller or if you're a performer or if you're on TV, that suit does not look so good 5 years later because the styles have changed completely. So it's not like if you have 400 suits, they will last you forever. I'll tell you what, man. You know what I have to say about Antoine and the fact that he'd buy 82 suits every single year? Damn good thing my man didn't play baseball. Longtime friend of mine, Eric Musselman. Mus, what's going on? How you doing?
I'm doing great, JR. Thanks so much for having me back in the jungle. It's always awesome.
EP Mus, always good to have you. Let me first ask you about the fam. Mariah celebrated a birthday earlier this week. How is she doing, and what's it been like watching her grow up?
Oh my gosh, as you know, Jim, having kids, it goes so fast, but I think too, when you're in coaching, there's so many cool things, but then there's also sacrifices that, you know, that the family has. And, I wasn't actually at her original birthday party because we were on the road, playing Missouri. And so, you know, you miss that time. But then it's cool for her to bring all her friends to the game last night and watch us play. But it's awesome. Being a dad's a lot harder than being a coach.
Eric Musselman joining us, no doubt about that. So you mentioned last night you beat Florida, and that was your seventh straight SEC win. There's this great clip of you after the game calling the Hogs with the student section. How much fun was it to do that? And even if there aren't as many fans as there normally would be, what's it like to have that energy in the arena?
Well, it was great because we have really bad weather right now in Fayetteville, Jim. So what ended up happening is we got together with administration and marketing and sent out a lot of emails actually to season ticket holders just asking kind of who was not going to be there. And then we could use those tickets, turn around and give them to the student section, because obviously with COVID, you know, we've had a lot more students get into games and actually have been able to come and attend. And we had an incredible student section last night, and it was basically students just because the roads were so bad and the kids on campus could just walk to the arena. But it was awesome. The day before, I went sledding with some fraternities, and there was a sorority up there. And so we got that group of people kind of fired up to come to the game, and then it was our job to figure out how to get them tickets.
Eric, you know, it's funny you mention that, because not long ago, I went back to our shared old stomping grounds, Pacific Beach, and it was a kick, man. I hadn't been there in a while, but I went back and took the family back there. When you mentioned that you went sledding, you know, as somebody who's got that California background, what was it like? How did that treat you? How did that go for you?
Well, I know the Pacific Beach down there on the boardwalk is a little bit different than sledding. And it was pretty cool when I first walked out there. A lot of the frats had skateboards, and they had taken the wheels off the skateboard, and were just going down the hill. I texted my wife and tried to get permission to do that. She said, no way. It's day before the game, so I had to go old school sled, something that probably a 9 or 10 year old would ride on. But a little bit colder than Pacific Beach for sure, JR.
Eric Musselman's joining us. That is so funny. Listen, I would argue the significance of last night's win. To fully understand that, Eric, you probably have to go back to Saturday's overtime win over number 10 Missouri. The win snapped the program's 12-game road losing streak against top 10 teams. Afterwards, you went with the signature shirtless look for the celebration in the locker room. So when you work and you grind as hard and as much as you and your staff and your players do, man, how sweet is that moment to get a win like that?
No, I mean, it's huge for our program because, you know, there's national significance, which impacts recruiting, and it impacts, you know, former students that are living outside of the region to watch a game and to get more excited about the program. But really, you know, the key, Jim, is like in college, like you can let your guard down. You can have fun with them. At the end of the day, they are student athletes that are developing life skills and they grind, man. This has not been an easy season for anybody in any sport, whether it's collegiately or professionally. There's a lot of commitment that goes into it. And so we want to have fun, you know, we don't want to have fun after a loss, but after a big win, we want to celebrate. I want the guys to have passion in the locker room for their teammates and enjoy the moment.
Eric, I mean, clearly you have completely reinvented yourself. You've gone to the college level and you worked your way up through that level and you've had a lot of success there. I know you're really happy doing what you're doing and you're having a lot of success doing it. Do you ever think about the NBA? Do you miss the NBA?
You know, it's a great question, Jim. I love where I'm at. You know, a Power Five job at a school that really believes in basketball. Like Arkansas, it's an awesome job. I feel so fortunate that I was in the NBA and kind of grew up in it with my dad. And I think there's a lot of college coaches that's always in the back of their mind. For me, this is like perfect timing at this stage of my life. You know, 82 games is a grind. You know, you talk to people when they first get into it that don't know the grind of the travel, and you wake up in a hotel and you don't even know what city you're in or what day of the week it is. But I've enjoyed having an impact on younger people. I've actually enjoyed the recruiting process because in my mind, recruiting is just a form of competition and you're trying to, you know, beat somebody for a top level talent, and then you get the opportunity to develop the player. So for me, I'm really happy. But the NBA, hey, it's awesome. It's the world's greatest players. You know, the referees are great. The arenas are incredible. The hotels you stay in, the travel, all that stuff is awesome. And I think NBA coaching is so underrated. You know, I think college coaching is overrated, and I think NBA coaches are way underrated.
That's really interesting. What do you mean by that?
I just think that in-game adjustments, you know, when I was in the NBA, you know, when you have to coach against Pat Riley or Phil Jackson or Jeff Van Gundy, and they each had their own reason for being great. Like Jeff Van Gundy, I felt like our team could never get more than a 4-0 or 6-0 run. I felt like he had 1,000 timeouts because every time we'd go on a scoring run, he'd call a timeout and break your momentum. And guys like Hubie Brown, you know, I had an internal clock that if the game was going down to the wire, because I had worked for him, I knew that he was going to have an incredible late game package. And so I told our staff every time we played Memphis that we had to get out to a lead in the last 2 minutes because he was going to be able to win any close game because of his X and O's and his preparation with late game plays. So I think that just the NBA guys, they're immersed in 82 games. So when you get to coach 82 games as opposed to 30 games, you're going to become better in your craft. And then when you don't have to get on the phone and recruit, and you're only dealing with basketball 100% of the time, you're naturally going to become a better coach. And then I also think that there's so many former players that are coaches at the NBA level. And I do think if those guys work on their craft, they have a leg up.
Eric Musselman is joining us. It's a great response, Mus. You know, I always talk about the fact that you and I have known each other. In fact, when I look at my career, I probably knew you professionally before I knew anybody else. You and I go back to the mid-80s. You recently had a tweet of a newspaper clipping from the Clippers and the draft room back in 88. It's a photo of you with Barry Hecker and Gene Shue. What did you learn from Gene Shue back in the day?
Oh, my gosh. So the relationship with Gene Shue, JR, actually started when I was a ball boy for the San Diego Clippers. And he was coaching that group of World Be Free and Randy Smith and Sven Nader. He had a unique way of playing pick and roll. If a pick and roll was happening on the right side of the floor, he would have the left wing guy be at the nail or at the top of the key, and that guy would actually fly onto the pick and roll as the ball handler was driving at you. And it was kind of like a fly switch. And I haven't seen anybody do that since. He was way ahead of his time on three-point shooting and taking quick shots. He did it with the San Diego Clippers, and then with the LA Clippers, he did it as well. And people don't realize he was a great player, and he invented the spin move.
That is something. I did not know that, actually. That is something. Eric Musselman's joining us. I didn't know that. Now, when you talk, Eric, about breaking something out, when you and I spoke in December, we talked about your big man, Connor Vanover. And he had a tough game against Missouri earlier in the year. He went 0-for-11 from the field, but this time he went 5-for-7, and you were running a different offense for him, including some five-down stuff. When was the last time you ran that five-down, and then how pleased were you with the way Vanover dealt with it?
Well, what happened was Missouri was switching, because Connor Vanover is a 7-foot-3 pick-and-pop player who likes to roam on the perimeter and shoot threes, but he's a really good post-up player, and you know, when I was with the Timberwolves, Randy Brewer was 7'3", and I actually think Connor could have an impact like Randy Brewer did down low with a sky hook. We're trying to get Connor to 1,000% buy into the sky hook. But Missouri put a guard on him. We called a timeout. I diagrammed five down. You're right, JR. It's a play that we ran for Eric Dampier when I was with the Golden State Warriors, and we hadn't run it at all, and he scored three straight times, and then he had two great passes once they started to semi-trap him. And we'll add that to our playbook. Hopefully Connor will want to go down there and bang a little and utilize his size and his jump hook because he's got an incredible touch around the rim.
I was going to say, why is he resisting the sky hook? Like, bad look, not feeling it? I mean, he does know that it's impossible to defend, right?
Well, I think what year we're in, you know, when you think about 2021 – moving forward, 2020, everybody wants to play on the perimeter. And he is a great, great three-point shooter. But I agree with you, Jim, that if you go down there and you're that size, you cannot block that shot. And, you know, I think more players, today's players, instead of watching today's NBA game, you know, like big men should watch Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and how he used to annihilate people down low. And even big guards, if they watched Magic Johnson and the way that he played in the post, or people always talk about Larry Bird's passing and his three-point shooting. Larry Bird was an incredible post-up player. The footwork that Kevin McHale used in the post, his up and under moves. More younger players need to dig in to some of the old school guys and how they created their own shot.
I love that. Eric Musselman joining me for another moment or so. He's the head coach at Arkansas. They're top 25 right now. Mus, you mentioned what it was like to go up against some of the best back in the day, Phil Jackson, Hubie Brown, and then you mentioned Pat Riley. What was it like to coach against Riley back in the day?
Well, his teams were so physical. When I was coaching against him, he was with Miami, and they had Alonzo Mourning. And even when he was with New York, the thing that amazed me, Jim, is when you're in staff meetings, and it's happened, you know, for me for a long time, you'd be in staff meetings and you'd be talking about trapping the pick and roll or hard hedging the pick and roll, meaning the big would come out and quickly attack the ball handler. And everybody would say, well, big, slower centers can't do that. Well, Pat Riley, it was not an option, man. Like, Patrick Ewing had bum knees, struggled laterally at times. He was out there hard hedging and trapping like he was a 6-foot guard because Coach Riley drilled it, demanded it, and then his teams in Miami were so physical. And I don't think I've ever seen an NBA team contest the ball when it was shot like Pat Riley's teams. We actually, when we contest shots here, we call those Pat Riley contests, because I was mesmerized by how the effort and the energy that his guys did with closeouts.
So, Mus, is that what it means when people constantly talk about the Heat culture? Is that effectively what we're talking about, the energy and toughness that they play with?
No question, and it starts in practice. Like, it actually starts when they do their conditioning drill prior to training camp, and you're not allowed on the practice floor until you pass that. And so guys come into training camp knowing that they have to be in great physical condition. And I learned all that as an assistant coach working for Doc Rivers, Doc's first year coaching. I was an assistant for him, Jim, with Orlando, and we had to do that conditioning test. It's the only time in my coaching career where I feared that a guy could go down by working so hard. I remember the conditioning drill, and it was literally the first time I walked over to Tim Welsh, the trainer, and I'm like, man, is this even healthy?
Right.
But that's the Heat culture.
Eric Musselman is the head basketball coach at Arkansas, second season there. I ran down the numbers. They're great. Longtime friend of the program, and they are number 24 in the AP poll. They are taking on Texas A&M Saturday. Mus, you murdered that segment. Great job, Mus. Great to get caught up with you, and it's always good to have you on the show. Tell Danielle all my best, and it's always good to talk to you.
JR, great talking with you. Thanks for having me in the jungle. Hey, we got to set a date, man. Got to go to Pacific Beach, grab a burrito, and watch the Padres sometime this summer.
Good night now!